Welcome, Capital Racers. On today's show, Clint Jameson joins me to talk about making the jump from houses to syndications, getting into his first large-scale multifamily deal, and starting his first fund. We also go into built-to-rent developments and why it is a lucrative alternative compared to many other multifamily sub-niche syndications. If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop on capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show, episode 244, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Flint Jameson on the Capital Raiser Show, my friend, my partner. How the heck are you, man? Welcome to the show.
Dude, it has been a long time coming. We've been wanting to do this for a while.
I'm excited to have a partner, a co-GP partner that maybe, who knows, down the road could be a full-blown
could
partner
do
of
something.
Legacy. We'll see.
There's something cooking.
we got a bunch of stuff cooking. So Capital Raiser Show Season 3, now brought to you by Pitch Decks, my friends over at Richard Wilson's family office and their affiliated company. So really excited to be working with them. Flint, you and I are part of the Real Estate Accelerator. You also joined me and some of my friends that did the Creative Capital Challenge. That was, I think, how we originally started talking. That was a year ago, more or less.
Over a year ago.
Maybe last month, a year ago. So that's been really cool. So I've been getting to know you very well. We get to hang out quite a bit, but the audience may not know you as well as I do. Can you break down a little bit about your background, where you're at in life? Where are you at on your multifamily journey and how you got into this space?
Yeah, I am a mechanical engineer that went into aerospace. I've spent 18 to 20 years in aerospace. I designed aircraft like the 787. Now I've been a program manager for the last 5 years doing a $120 million program to modify aircraft. Think Monster Garage for the military. Ooh. We just take a standard commercial aircraft or biz jet, roll it in the hangar, and it rolls out doing some cool stuff. I've been moonlighting as a real estate person and doing that program management role for several years now.
And then how did you get into real estate? So at what point did you realize that, hey, maybe I should start doing real estate? Did you start with houses? Did you go right into multifamily?
Yeah.
I want to hear more about this.
We always start out there where there's this pipe dream of, you hear of someone that owns real estate and they don't have to work anymore. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to do that. And I started just listening to Bigger Pockets podcast. And at some point, 2018, I bird a duplex. It was remote. I'm in Denver. That was in Milwaukee. Class C, hard money loan to buy. It was $80,000 cash. I put in $30,000 to renovate it. It was supposed to be $20,000. It was supposed to take 3 months to renovate. It took 6 months. I was sitting on that hard money loan, 12% interest. It was painful. But the duplex, I had it. It cash flowed actually really well. It was profiting $300 per unit. I was doing pretty good. Bigger Pocket says, I think it's $200 per unit is profit is kind of average. So I thought after all the pains of the burr, I was doing pretty well. And then I sold it in April. But after that, I realized that in order to get financially free through that method, I would have to go out and get 50 doors. So if I was to do duplexes or fourplexes, I'd have to do that 15 to 25 more times. And I knew I didn't have it in me. That's a lot of capital, a lot of pains, a lot of stress, a lot of hard money loan. And then I discovered syndications and I haven't looked back.
Did you hear about that through Bigger Pockets as well? Or where did you hear about
it? I did. I was actually a Michael Blanc podcast, or Michael Blanc was interviewed on Bigger Pockets. And then from there, I digested Michael Blanc's podcast for about 6 months before taking a leap and getting trained up.
I had a very similar mindset. I was like, because I bought a bunch of fourplexes with a specific partner back in 2009 and 10. And then after he split up, I was like, okay, so how am I going to create generational wealth? I was like, well, I know fourplexes. If I buy one fourplex, pay down the equity, use it to get another fourplex, that'll double my portfolio, pay that down and double that. So I'll go from one fourplex to two to four to eight to 16. And then after 32 fourplexes, I'll have 128 units and it'll pay itself off and I'll be financially set for the rest of my life. And I was all, kind of proud of my trajectory. And I told this kind of plot to somebody at the local Arizona Real Estate Investors Association. They're like, 128 units. Why don't you just take them all down right now? And I was like, wait, Well, I don't know how to do that. What are you talking about? So I got lucky. I got introduced I didn't even know podcasts existed when I found out about the word syndication. And then I did a Google search on syndication or something like that. And all of a sudden it was everywhere, like on my Instagram feed, all these gurus, on my Facebook feed. I'm like, how come these guys weren't here before? Like, it's so weird.
Exactly. It's so funny. There's so many podcasts. There's so much information out there, but so many people have no clue it exists. Mm-hmm. There's even people in real estate who have no clue about it.
That is kind of trippy. There's people in real estate that do. So I'm thinking, shout out to my old real estate broker, Patrick O'Sullivan. He knew about syndication because he sold. He specialized in commercial real estate and sold some of my old friends their first syndications. And I was like, hey, Patrick, who do you know that does syndication? They're like, oh, you should go talk to these guys. I'm like, set up an appointment. So I go to Bakerson, my old team, and I'm like, hey, guys, thanks for letting me interview you. Can you tell me, like, I'm very curious about syndication. I want to know, who do I need to have on my team? And they're like, well, what do you care? I'm like, well, I used to raise capital back in the day for small multiplexes. And they're like, really? Instead of going to a guru and getting trained and paying a bunch of money, why don't you just come join us? So I did an apprenticeship with them for about 18 to 20 months, something like that. And then kind of grew my wings, started the Capital Raiser Show, and then got into fund management with Andy McMullen, Legacy Acquisitions. And people started to like what we were doing at Legacy, including you. So now we got a bunch of co-GPs and we're really excited about the future. So I know that you did a fund or a fund of funds,
fund. Yeah. So
did you do any big multifamily before doing that fund? I'm curious about this.
Yeah. So the velocity of where I started to where I'm at now is kind of crazy.
I know.
So let's go back to the very beginning. We did that Creative Capital Challenge. The reason I know this is because this is my first failure. It was August of 21 and joined you guys doing this Creative Capital Challenge. I'm trying to take down a 23 unit here in Aurora with a newbie group of GPs. All of us are newbie. I'm the only boots on the ground guy. Man, I love the boots on the ground stuff. But that deal failed for so many reasons. But one of the reasons, we couldn't raise capital. And I was in that Creative Capital Challenge. It was like the second or third day in, we had to back out of the deal and I lost a whole bunch of earnest money.
Oh no.
Yeah. So the third day into the Creative Capital Challenge, I had to back out of that deal. So then I doubled down. I joined RIA and I said, my weak spot is raising money. I got to hit my weak spot and train myself up. So 3 months later, I get invited on to do a 100 unit in Augusta, Georgia with Chris Roberts and Paul Wilcox at Sterling Rhino.
Okay, I know what deal you're talking about.
First successful raise. And yeah, that one closed in February of this year. So 104 units, February this year. By April, Annie from Good Egg talks to me about this giant fund they're doing of three properties. It was supposed to be a $50 million fund. Like, oh, I could do a fund of fund with you guys? Because that's what they do. They help us. We're part of their team. They help us. And so they basically held my hand. I started a fund. I'm now a fund of fund manager. But I brought friends along with me because I knew I couldn't raise all the capital that was needed. So I brought a bunch of other newbie capital raisers and we did it. Closed on that throughout the summer, those three properties. And
I want to hear about what you learned about that deal. Particularly, pretend that the audience is looking at you and they're like, oh, man, like, I want to participate in a 104 unit deal. And I've never done anything like that. Like, I probably round up anywhere from like $50,000 to $350,000, but I don't know how to do that. Like, how do I find a sponsor that I can trust? I'm scared to do this, but I know that I have to do this because I've been sitting around on the sidelines for way too long. And there's this amazing thing called syndication and this tool and all these people, I see their posts on Facebook and LinkedIn every day. Like, I want to do this too.
Yeah.
But I'm like terrified. I don't know what the hell I'm doing yet.
How do you get your foot in the door? So with Chris and Paul, we were networking for almost a year. So flashback to January of 21. This is 8 months before my failure here in Aurora, that 23 unit we had to back out on. For some reason, I ended up on the phone with Chris Roberts. I don't even know why, but the thing that sticks out is we talked on the phone from like 10 o'clock to 11:30 at night.
That's how he is, dude. He can talk your ear off. He's so generous with his time.
And he's so energetic. I got off the phone at 11:30 at night and I was just jazzed. My wife's like, what's wrong with you? Like, I just talked to this guy and I'm just jazzed. Anyway, I met them probably 10 months before I got invited onto their deal. But the other reason is I ran into him at a networking event. It was Michael Blanc's conference. I just randomly ran into those guys. Hey, Chris, Paul, what's going on? And they're like, hey, Flint. And so then I started talking to them more. And they were, I think, some of the original members for the Good Egg Rhea team.
Yeah.
And I was like, what'd you guys think of Rhea? And Paul just straight up said, just do it. It's like, okay, I will just do it. And I think because of that, I proved that I was putting my money forward and I was dedicating my time to figuring out how to do it. And they actually said, hey, Flint, we got this deal. They were actually bringing in newbie investors. They're givers. They love trying to mentor. They've been there. Said, hey, I want in on the deal. And they said, can you raise 500? And I was like, no, it's my first raise. Can I do 250? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. You can do that. I had to fight tooth and nail to get to 250. You know how the first raise goes, but I made it. It took us 2 months to get there. Raising over the holiday season is really hard, but that's how I got in on that first deal. The second one, Annie and Julie, I'd been part of their Rhea group forever. Obviously that relationship was there. They basically raised an army of capital raisers. So they're trying to capitalize on that themselves. They're just doing massive funds. So if you have an army, utilize them. So that's where the fund-to-fund comes in.
Yeah, Rhea is one of the greatest investments I ever made in my entire life. For anybody that's thinking about doing it, number one, you can get like $1,000 if you mention the Capital Raiser Show. But number two, they've done all these crazy things like help people understand automations or do it for you blog posts. And they provide all this cool stuff. And I've been talking to Annie and Julie lately, and they're telling me that because I'm like, hey, I'm getting ready to start my own capital raising coaching program. And they're like, oh, you know, let me give you some advice. And I'm like, so what's going on with Rhea? And they're like, oh, we're getting ready to launch a Rhea 2.0. And I'm like, a 2.0? What is it in 2.0 that you're going to teach that you're not already teaching? They're like, you have learned how to create a funnel. You've learned automations. You've learned branding. You've learned avatar creation. And you're making money and creating generational wealth for people. Now, Rhea 2.0 is we're going to teach you how to extract yourself from the capital raising business and make it so that you can run that capital raising business without actually being there. And I was just like my mind exploded. Whoa. I was like, no way. Like, I'm like, is this how you go and spend a month in France in the middle of a capital raise? And Annie was just like, yep, that's exactly it. And now it's our job to teach our students how to do that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm pumped up about that. So
what's funny,
those guys.
Yeah, I do. What's funny is I just backed out of there because it's a subscription model. You pay money every month. And I was like, I think I got what I needed. I'm exiting my day job. So I'm trying to cut back on some of those expenses, but Man, if it's really good, I'm pretty sure though I can be like, Annie, can I pay you guys your monthly dues again? Because they'll probably let me in.
Yeah, I got some pull. I'm sure that I can swing something. They're handing off Rhea. Like, they don't even run it anymore. Now Quentin runs it. I don't know if you've met him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like, they're hands off on that too. They're like hands off on everything. They're just like removing themselves and like not being, they're just on that CEO level.
Yeah, and Julie's just living up life in Hawaii.
Is she still there? She's been there for like 3 or 4 months. I thought that was a vacation.
No, she lives there.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the art of the possible for capital raisers. You can just live in Hawaii and stop your day job.
Wow. We'll get there. Yeah. That's what funds are for, is and like podcasts and hanging out with other capital raisers that are scaling. This is what's available for you. And it could happen very quickly. Like, dude, I wasn't in syndication at all 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Didn't even know what the word meant.
It's true.
Okay. So
back on your fund question, what I learned is, for one, as a fund of a fund, your fund is an LP to the primary fund. So you have no control, which is really cool because my responsibilities on any of the asset side are not there. However, I have to manage all the accounting and taxes and K-1 and distributions and updates, right? It's like I'm running an operation with no operation.
Literally, you have your own security, dude. Like, yeah. You have filed.
We had to pay the SEC attorneys to draft our own PPM. We have our own operating documents. And I think it's a great learning experience. And I'm still in the middle of this learning experience and I've been doing it for 9 months. But in my head, I'm like, wow, you can't get in on a fund of fund unless you understand your costs and know that you have enough spread between what the primary fund pays you and what you pay your investors depending because there's costs and you have to take some off the top. So to put this in example, say there is, you give your investors a 7 pref, you need to have like a 9 or 10 pref. So you have enough meat on the bone that you can skim off the top to cover expenses and be able to pay yourself. Otherwise, it's just going to cost you money out of your pocket just to have investors make money.
That's one way to do it. I would say that some people would even charge a fee to their investors. They're like, hey, we're going to give you access to stuff that you have no ability to get access to. In some of these cases, like they won't even bother to have you come and join as one of the investors unless you have $1 million. And
correct.
You know, if you enter with us, we're going to stroke $1 million check. You only have to bring 50,000 of that. So that's one way. And you can do it the way that you talked about. It's a perfectly legit way too.
Yeah. I didn't actually think of that as an option to have the investors pay the fee. I can't wrap my head around that right now. I got to see that on paper.
Yeah, there's so many different things. And there's probably like another 35 ways to do it. Every time that I talk to a syndicator or fund manager, or a lawyer, even a syndication attorney, they all know different things and use different terminologies. It's like college football. They all run the same plays, but they have different vocabulary for running same plays.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of a trip.
And then you get into other types of funds, your blind funds, your evergreen funds, and then your mind just goes crazy.
Yeah. I went to Richard Pennington's conference and he told me, because like my brain is all about real estate funds. And then at that, there's a bunch of other kinds of funds that they're talking about there. And one of them was just like a dude bought Bitcoin in the United States and sold the Bitcoin in Korea. And there was an arbitrage there and he became a billionaire. I forget what his name is. Yeah. Just like by changing the price of one thing and selling it at another in a different place where it's in greater demand that they don't have access to. Like you can literally, I was just like, oh my God. There's all kinds of crazy stuff that you guys could do with funds. I'm sure that we'll continue to talk about it in massive amounts of detail in the Capital Raiser Show season 3. It's a really exciting thing. And Hunter Thompson, one of our friends, he did his very first capital raise in a fund. So that is also possible for you. Because a lot of people are like, oh, I have to do 16, 17 syndications before I can ever do a fund. That's so not true. I mean, you did one on your second deal, right? On your second.
So that's so here's amazing. The thing though, you got to think a single property can be called a fund.
I mean, a syndication is literally a fund.
There's really no difference from a paperwork structure between my fund of fund and a single property. It's all the same. We call it a fund because I was like, you with a single investment, you get 750 units over 3 different cities and 2 states. You get diversified across these properties with your $150,000 investment. So, I think investors, right, the outsiders are like, oh, I get the fund now. But if you call a single property a fund, it breaks people's heads, but it's the same.
It is. And that's where the term fund to funds comes from.
Yeah.
And like, I had one person say, I'm like, hey, if I start a fund to funds and I'm the fund manager and I was asking him, I'm like, and I invest in someone's syndication. I was curious, can my fund raise from capital raisers? And then they get their database of LPs that go into my fund and then my fund invests in another one. And he told me that's like, you want to be careful about how many layers are between the investors. And then I brought this up with Mauricio Raul and he's like, oh, I don't see any problem with that at all. Just imagine like if you're raising for $1 billion fund, like how many capital raisers do you need to have $1 billion fund? It's going to be a ton and there's going to be some layers.
So this is the way you got to play that careful too. That's like, if you get to that level, it's all 506C. You can't have any Bs in there. That gets dangerous.
I don't mess around with 506Bs. I get nervous when people tell me, I ask them a lot of times, what kind of deals do you do, 506B or 506C? And when they say B, like I've got my radar up. I want to make sure that they don't condition the market or do anything. And most of the time they're pretty good, but I've caught a few people talking about, oh, you know, we just put a sign up on our property. I'm like, dude, you just conditioned the market, dude. You can't be talking about 506B deal if you're not even purchased it yet. And so that kind of stuff, man, you got to be careful.
Even after you close, you got to be super careful with your wording. You can't say, hey, we just closed on this deal, which is 506B. If you want to get in on the next one, you've just violated. All you can say is, I'm super excited. We closed on a deal, right? That's about the max you can say.
Here's one thing that I'm curious about. And if you are listening to this and you know the answer, I'm going to be interviewing a lawyer in January. I'll have to bring this up with her. If your intention is to do a 506C on a deal, but you do not have yet the syndication structure in place. Can you talk about that deal, even though you haven't finished getting it under contract and will be doing a 506C? If you do not have that yet, can you talk about that legally? I'm very curious about that.
That's interesting. I never thought of it that way, but I don't think, why not? Why would you have to have the paperwork in place to talk about it?
That's my belief. If I know I'm going to go 506C, that means I'm not going to violate anything.
Yeah.
Now, if I talk about something and then we don't have it under contract and then we decide to go 506B, at that point, I'm screwed.
Now you're, yeah.
So that's the kind of stuff, that's exactly why I want to stay as far away from 506B as possible. And I understand we will be turning away some people that are non-accredited, but that's the price you pay for being liberal, I think.
Yeah, I still have a fair amount of sophisticated investors that I want to bring a deal to. Yeah, you got to be very careful who you choose, who your partners are. And yeah, you don't say anything about it anywhere.
If you do talk to a lawyer, I'm pretty sure you can set up a 506.
Oh, I know where you're going with this. This is awesome.
No, I get these two backwards. Because I know a 506C can definitely invest in a 506B fund. I don't know if a 506, I know that there's some way to do it, but I don't know how I don't know how to eloquently say it. Although I think Mauricio talked about it. If you have like a specific trigger in your fund that you raise $5 million or something like that, then you can, is that what it is?
Yes. So we can talk about our friend Brian Briscoe. He's got his two evergreen funds. One's 506C, one's 506B. As soon as that 506B hits a $5 million net worth, I guess.
Threshold, I think, of money threshold, that invests into the deal.
He can now get those investors into 506C deals. I don't know how that works, but I know as long as that 506B fund reaches a $5 million, you're now open season.
Very cool. Okay, so you've learned syndication, you've learned funds, and then all of a sudden interest rates start going bonkers earlier this year.
Yeah.
And then you hear people getting really excited about sub niches of multifamily, including development. You start hearing me talk about build to rent. What was it particularly that made you interested in shifting directions from multifamily value add and hotels into this whole nother world of development that you didn't know too much about? And I didn't know anything about it either about a year and a half ago, by the way.
That's a great question. I don't know why I was so triggered and excited about build to rent. I think that I knew just enough about it to think or to know that it was the new hottest thing out there. And ever since diving in even further, it's kind of one of the new hottest things out there, and it's not going away. Man. There's so many billions of dollars of institutional money wanting to buy that stuff up, and they don't build. They need us to build, and then they'll come buy it up from us.
Yeah. Neil Bauer is famous for sure. He talks about that all the time. He lists off the funds like JP Morgan Chase and who knows who.
Oh, yeah. I love those charts.
And then on the team call earlier today, the biggest fund in the country that purchases build to rent, they're actually the ones that give our lender money to buy our projects. And I'm like, really? Like, tell me a little bit more about that. And they're just like, Arbor, they get their money from a fund. I believe I'm saying this correctly. Don't quote me on this, but like the biggest fund invest in the country invest into our deals, the stuff that we have cooking, which are all 506C, by the way.
This is probably like Blackstone gives Arbor a bunch of money to give us lending, and then, you know, it comes full circle. They just buy the property off of us after we build it.
Yeah, well, they have debt funds, they have real estate funds, they got all kinds of funds, and, you know. So what else have you learned along the way? Because I was very intimidated by it. I was like, I don't know how to get the zoning laws. After a while, like, I started to realize the numbers made a ton of sense. It's very lucrative. We could double investor money very quickly. We could offer pretty high IRRs. And then not only that, like, here's one of my favorite things that I've learned, or that I've started kind of promoting, is that on a $30 million value add, you might have to raise $9 million to get the loan, and then another $3 million or more for renovation. So you got a $12 million capital raise on a $30 million deal. But on a $30 million build to rent, you might invest $2 million to do infrastructure, get a 60% loan to cost loan, and then complete infrastructure. And all of a sudden, it's worth about $6 or $7 million. And then on a $30 million build out, if you already have $6 or $7 million in equity, now you only have to raise like another $2 million bucks. So instead of raising 12 million, you've only raised like $4 or $5 million. So who gets to keep all that extra pie? It's like the GPs and the LPs. It's just, it's so incredible. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you make money every step along the way. You're forcing appreciation. At the end of the day, you end up with this product that's maintenance free, brand new, and it's completely sexy. And the renters want to stay there for 40 months on average instead of 18. And they're tired of living in apartments. So, I mean, from every perspective that I've learned about it so far, it makes sense. And then I just had to wrap my head around this, which is like, I don't have to know how thick the insulation is or what shingles are going to be put on the roof and how thick they are or anything like that. I don't need to answer every single little question around the way. All I have to do is be excited about this, meet people, share what I know. And then whatever questions they have, we have developers, acquisition specialists. We got people that are on the equity side, the people that are underwriting side, an entire team that can walk people through Syndication Pro. This is exactly what you have access to. And all our potential future capital raisers, including ones that come from you, will have access to all the same things. So it's just like, I don't need to know everything to do this business. I just got to have a good team in place. And we do. So
it's funny you mentioned this, because I was just on a call with a potential investor and they were diving really deep into some things that most investors don't care about. But they were asking about, like, hey, this floor plan, where are the windows on the side? It doesn't look like they have windows on the sides of these buildings. And it's just, their background is doing all these short-term rentals. Like, they are retired doing short-term rentals and they want to start investing passively. So they just come from a different background. They started asking all these detailed questions. I'm like, to be honest, I have no idea. Let me get you on the phone with Derek.
Derek is our builder. He's pretty amazing. I wish I could show you a picture of the stuff that he's got going on right now. Anyways, okay, so you're into build to rent, you've done funds. What does the future hold? Are you going to stick around in the build to rent space with us or with other groups? Or are you going to get back into multifamily syndication? I think the fund that you did with Annie was in hotels, if I'm correct. Is that right?
No, this was just before hotels. So they did hotels before and after. This was a 3 multifamily assets on that fund. So it was a class A off of the developer, which is a really fun. I've never done that before. For everyone's edification, a class A off the developer, there's plenty of meat on the bone, even though it's brand new, because developers cannot sell their commercial property until it has revenue, right? Everything is valuation is based on revenue. So they get people in there as fast as possible. They give first and last months free.
I never knew that.
Garage is free. They get like comps galore. The rents are low, get people in there as fast as possible because they don't want this on the books anymore. They got to sell it.
Ah.
So we can come in and buy it from them. And immediately we get rid of the comps.
I never understood why they were putting crappy renters, low under market renters in. Now that makes sense.
You just got to get rid of it. So yeah, there's meat on the bone with the Class A. Now we have something that's super low maintenance, super sexy property. I mean, this is Class A plus. Call it the flagstone of the fund. It's just beautiful property. But to be honest, the big money makers are the other two that are vintage late 80s value adds. Those are the ones that are going to really be making the money.
Yeah, Class C usually does pretty good. I think I'd rather own a brand new property. However, I get it. There's a lot of money in back end spread in Class C, even in hotel conversions or heavy lift, like completely gutting buildings. There's a lot of money to be made there. So I understand it. So there's an announcement that we need to make that we haven't really got to, and we're about to get ready to launch the lightning round. So what's going on with your W-2?
Yeah.
I want to hear about what's cooking there. How much longer do you think that you're going to be working there? I mean,
so
when can you become financially free?
At least
to the point where you can leave your job.
Yeah. So I gave my notice a week ago. I'm going to collect my holiday pay, give them another 2 weeks of transition time. I'm a PM. I got to give them some time to transition. Yeah, I'm jumping ship. Now, here's the thing. We could go down this rabbit hole. I don't know how far you want to go, but I've been going down this rabbit hole because everybody has a different situation and a different reason for when they think that they can jump ship out of their W-2. Some people think they need to completely replace their income, which may be true. If you're the sole breadwinner and you have kids and a wife, yeah, you might be stuck doing that. For me, my wife makes good money. Yeah, I quit. We're probably cutting our salary in half, our household salary in half. It's not that bad, but I'm just, think of the worst case scenario. This is what I had to go through mentally to convince myself it's time to go. I had a high performance coach help me through this. So he's like, Flint, let's just say you make $0 for the first 3 months. Will you survive? Yeah. How confident are you within 6 months that you're going to be making something? I said, absolutely confident. He said, all right, let's assume worst case scenario at the end of the year, you only make 50% of what you're hoping to make. Are you going to quit syndications and go back to work and get that income back because that year was too hard? And you're like, no way. I put way too much effort. If I'm doubling down, I'm 50%, baby. I'm going to keep going. So at that point, I was like, all right, I'm going to have a talk with my wife. We're going to think about this. We can survive on a single income. And we'll just live a little differently for the short term and just assume I'm not making any money. But anything I bring in is bonus.
Cool. I thought you were going to go in a different direction with that and pull the Maurice Philogene and say, hey, you don't need to have $25 million worth of passive income. You are literally financially free as soon as all of your expenses are paid for by your passive income. I don't know if you have passive income, but that number could be like as little as $3,000 for some people. That's comfortable living if you're in Argentina or somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Actually, maybe we should move. To be honest, we're location free once I quit.
Wow. That's really cool. All right, man, we got to jump into the lightning round, dude. So the first question I have for you is best vacation you've ever taken.
All right, we're going to Antarctica. It's by far, out of all the seven continents, Antarctica is by far my favorite.
Really? What do you love about it so much?
Well, for one, I'm an adventurer. And you go down there, you are in just the most remote place on the planet.
Okay, that sounds cool.
And it is full of life every day. So we took a cruise ship out of Argentina, the southern point of Argentina, and sailed for 4 days across the Drake Sea, which is just brutal. I mean, you can imagine that ocean just rocking you, there's winds howling. But once you get down there and you get to the Antarctic Peninsula, you start seeing there's penguins everywhere. There's leopard seals, fur seals, elephant seals. You got whales. I think we saw four different types of whales, huge pods of orcas and humpback whales everywhere. My wife was in a kayak in calm waters amongst icebergs and a mama humpback and a baby humpback right there.
Wow, that sounds insane.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I hiked up to the peak of this little island that we're on, and we're looking down on the ocean on the other side, and there was humpbacks doing bubble netting, if you know what that is. They swim, the humpbacks will swim in a circle blowing bubbles and they trap fish and they come up from underneath. Come up from underneath and just, and so all these, it was just incredible.
I watched a lot of Discovery Channel. That's cool. Yeah, all right, next question. Favorite book of any kind?
Let's go with one of the most recent, Who Not How and Time Management. Those two are very complementary, but it's all about get somebody else who's an expert to do the things you aren't an expert in, because you're going to move so much faster rather than teaching yourself.
Yeah, and that's why we went after people like Derek Alexandrenko to be a part of our team, because we don't want to do what he does. All right, what is your secret getaway? Where do you go to when you want to get away?
As a family, we like to go just do weekend trips skiing. We're in Colorado. We go up to ski resort.
Fantastic. How long do you want to live?
Wow. Let's say 99.
Cool.
I don't have any reason for that. It just seems like a good number.
I think it is a good number. Where do you want to travel to that you've never been to?
Everywhere. Galapagos Islands.
Oh, that one's super high on my list.
Yeah.
Okay. Best way to raise capital from your perspective? Short answer on this.
The best way to raise capital for me has been LinkedIn. I have been dialed in and focused hard on LinkedIn. I don't really do much on any of the other platforms. And that's where I've got my most investors from.
Me too, actually. Do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
No, because I suffer from limiting beliefs just like everybody else. I don't have the hacks. I do have a high performance coach. Maybe that's my best hack because he really sets me straight.
I was just about to say, dude, you're quitting your job. That is a major breakthrough right there. Okay, how about this? When was the last time? This is that question that Andy McMullen asked me when he interviewed me on my own show. He's like, when was the last time you felt like a loser?
Jeez, I feel like it happens more often. It's like a monthly occurrence, weekly occurrence. I don't know that it's daily, but there's those times when it just gets hard. We're raising capital right now, and man, does it get hard. It is not easy.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Everybody says the same thing, man. They're like, I felt like a loser this morning, dude. It's so common, dude. I feel like a loser all the time because I'm just like, we have such high expectations for ourselves.
We do.
And like when we don't get close to hitting that, people are just like, hey, calm down, dude. Like, do you understand all the things that you just accomplished that like normal human beings don't do? And you're just like, yeah. Oh, but I know that I can do more. And I hate myself, you know? Anyways, how about this, man? What do you love best about international travel? You mentioned earlier today on my post on LinkedIn that you've been to 35 countries and 7 continents.
Yeah, I really got the travel bug when I moved to New Zealand back in the early 2000s. And the reason why is you separate yourself from the bubble and the life that you're used to growing up in. You live in a protective bubble with family around, friends around, restaurants you recognize. As soon as you force yourself out into something else, into some extreme, New Zealand's not an extreme by any means, but living somewhere solo, out of a backpack, putting yourself in that situation really changes you as a person. And it's changed me. Now take that, go to Africa and do some crazy stuff. You really absorb cultures and it's just, I think it's healthy. We all need to learn the world rather than live in our own bubble.
Beautiful. Okay. Have you ever experienced a miracle or have you ever had a near-death experience?
No. I've experienced some cool stuff, but thankfully no near-death experiences. Whew.
Okay. Last question brought to you by Shanna Amigo, one of our great listeners of the show. She wants to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
I keep telling people I want to do Engineers Without Borders because we can go create things like water filtration systems for tribes in Africa who have no access to healthy water. And you can teach them, we as a like an Engineer Without Borders would teach the locals how to do that again and again and again so they know how to create a healthy life for them and all their neighbors.
Love it. Very cool answers. Can't believe how fast the show has gone by. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation and to my company, Legacy Acquisitions, and our sponsors, Good Egg Investment, Syndication, Pro Apartment, Educators, The Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. If you want to pay full price for their programs, go direct to them. But if you'd like to save a little bit of cash, see what offers they have at CapitalRaiserShow.com. Flint, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
The best place... let's go to my website, vestuscapital.com, V-E-S-T-U-S-capital.com. You'll find all sorts of ways to contact me from there.
Cool. And if you guys are interested in Built to Rent, definitely talk to Flint. He's getting extremely savvy in this space. So I'm really excited to be working with him into the far future. All right. So with that, one last question of the day. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or syndicator as they scale in their journey?
Yes. Take action. You wouldn't believe where I would be right now if I had taken action 6 months, 9 months, or 12 months sooner. I tried to educate the living crap out of myself, and you don't need to. Just start taking action. Go to conferences, find partners, find mentorships. You will accelerate yourself much faster.
Dude, it's so fun when you have like a longtime friend on the show. You get to go a lot of fun directions. So I really appreciate you coming on, dude. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, peace and strength, dude.